It's Wednesday, May 13, 2015. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The secularization of America is one of the great facts of our time, and it doesn't come out of a vacuum, because long before America began showing the explicit signs of the secularization we now see, it was already evident in much of Europe, especially in Northern Europe. The historical trajectory goes back to the Enlightenment of the 17th century and then gains speed as you go forward, especially into the 20th century. By the time you got to the 18th and 19th century, a very thin slice of the intellectual elites were showing already that they were being secularized, that they were exchanging the Christian worldview for a secular worldview. But it took the last half of the 20th century for this to gain much speed in the general population, first looking at Europe and then also at North America. When secularization first began to appear, it was largely a phenomenon of the elites, and those who showed the earliest evidence of the secularization amongst the elites, they didn't just become non-believers, they became, in general, atheists, or skeptics, or agnostics. Now we have new evidence coming from the Pew Research Center that what's happening in the United States is a very different phenomenon, and it's happening very fast. We are watching millions of Americans shift from some religious affiliation to no religious affiliation. And the numbers are very stark. They're gaining headlines all over the world with the release of this study yesterday by the Pew Research Center. For instance, perhaps one of the factoids that has led to the greatest conversation is the fact that according to this massive Pew study, the number of non-aligned, that is, non-affiliated, religiously speaking, in America now exceeds the number of American Roman Catholics. That's a rather stunning development. For the better part of the last century, Catholics have numbered about 25% of the American population. And even as those numbers are not falling in terms of the absolute count, they are falling behind in terms of the growth of the American population. So if religious groups don't gain new converts, given the fact that America is gaining new citizens, eventually they become a smaller proportion of the total population. That's happening across the board when it comes to American religion. It happened very quickly within American Judaism, with a vast majority of American Jews identifying no longer with the theistic truth claims of Judaism, but rather with Judaism as a cultural identity. Then it also happened in mainline Protestantism, where vast numbers of members of what had been the most established churches and denominations in America began also to be highly secularized, first turning to a very liberal version of Christian theology, and eventually themselves or their children and grandchildren simply departing those churches and denominations altogether. It is happening now in other sectors of the American population. Nate Cohn, writing for the New York Times, tells us, quote, "The Christian share of adults in the United States has declined sharply since 2007, affecting nearly all major Christian traditions and denominations and crossing age, race, and region." Then again, citing the Pew Research Center. 71% of American adults were Christian in the year 2014. Now, that's clearly a majority, but it's a much smaller majority than was true just a matter of a few years before 2014. There is an absolute decline in numbers here of about 5 million, but there's a larger decline when it comes to percentage, a fall of about 8% since 2007. Alan Cooperman, the director of religious research at the Pew Research Center, the lead editor of this report, said, quote, "The decline is taking place in every region of the country, including the Bible Belt." Cohn then goes on to explain, quote, "The decline has been propelled in part by generational change, as relatively non-Christian millennials reach adulthood and generally replace the oldest and most Christian adults. But," he says, "it is also because many former Christians of all ages have joined the rapidly growing ranks of the religiously unaffiliated, or nuns, that's N-O-N-E-S, a broad category including atheists, agnostics, and those who adhere to, quote, nothing in particular." In terms of this study, the biggest insight is the pace, the velocity of the change. Tamara Aldi, writing for yesterday's edition of the Wall Street Journal, cites Greg Smith, one of the lead researchers for the project, as saying that the trends have, quote, "been underway for some time." He himself went on to observe, quote, "I am struck by the pace at which that group," meaning the religiously unaffiliated, "continues to grow." According to the study, the share of Americans who are unaffiliated by their own self-designation has risen to 22.8% from 16.1%. That's from just 2007 to 2014. In terms of a massive social change, this is something like warp speed. We're talking about the kind of change that has generally only been experienced in a time of severe cultural crisis, such as, in various turning points in human history, famine or war or poverty or plague. We're talking about something that is explainable only by other rapid changes taking place in our society. And as you're looking at the great moral revolution, so many things happening around us, those developments only make sense in light of this development. One of the most important things to look at here is generational change, and we'll be taking a look at that in coming days. This massive study demands a lot of our attention. It tells us a great deal about the massive shift in worldview taking place around us. But in looking at this generational change, one of the most interesting things is how successful, this is good news, how successful evangelical Christians have been in retaining millennials as over against virtually every other group, most importantly, mainline Protestants and even Roman Catholics. Sarah Eckhoff-Zylstra, writing for Christianity Today, points out that one of the insights from this study is that evangelical Christians convert many of their kids and then retain many of their kids. Pew found what it calls a remarkable degree of churn in the larger American religious landscape, but, says Zylstra, evangelicals are the major exception to the national pattern of Christian decline. Evangelical Christians were the only major Christian group in the entire study that gained more members than evangelical Christians lost through religious switching. That, again, is a very important issue. Now, evangelical Christians could find some false confidence in this, because even as we look at the fact that we're doing remarkably well at retaining our own young people, as compared with virtually every other religious group in America, the reality is we're not doing all that well when it comes to understanding that we're losing at least an enormous percentage of our own young people. And one of the things that becomes clear as we look at this research is what we talk about all the time, how much theology matters. Because the central truth is that it matters whether or not young people gain an active and eager convictional self-identity with the truth claims of the religious organization. That's what's clear. Whether you're looking at Judaism or mainline Protestantism or at evangelical Christianity or Catholicism. And as it turns out, the less theology you have, or the less theology you share and transfer, the less frequently, it turns out, the younger generation stays around. So there's a very clear message for us here about doctrine and theology, about the gospel and conversion. It's not enough that evangelical young people come at some point to identify with the gospel of Christ and even with evangelical Christianity. If they do not come to an open intellectual embrace, a heartfelt embrace of Christian truth, they're not going to continue to identify as the Christians their parents at some point think them to be. One of the interesting facts that comes out of this study is the fact that 60% of those who identify as evangelicals were raised as evangelicals, 14% were raised as mainline Protestants, 13% as Catholics, 7% as the unaffiliated, 3% as black Protestants, and 2% as other non-Christian faiths. So one of the things that also tells us is that evangelical Christians, though more successful at retaining our own and at converting others than the other groups that are documented here, we honestly aren't reaching as many of those outside our own evangelical circles as we might think we are. Let me just point to that last number. Only 2% of those who currently identify as evangelical Christians in this study were in any non-Christian faith before they identified as evangelical Christians. Finally, as I said, we'll be looking at other facets of this study in days ahead. It's worthy of that kind of attention. It's so effective in helping to explain the world around us. But finally, in terms of covering this issue today, I want to point to what might be called a new Pauline Kael moment. Pauline Kael was the theater critic of the New York Times. In 1972, after Richard Nixon was reelected in a landslide, Pauline Kael was famously quoted as saying it couldn't have happened because no one she knew had voted for Richard Nixon. There are questions as to whether she actually said that, although it's been authoritatively traced to her. But she did say in her own newspaper, just a matter of days after the election, quote, "I live in a rather special world. I know only one person who voted for Nixon. Where they are, I don't know. They're outside my ken, but sometimes when I'm in a theater, I can feel them," end quote. Now, the reality of that Pauline Kael quote is that it doesn't tell us anything about America. It tells us a lot about Pauline Kael. It tells us that even when Richard Nixon won 49 states, losing only Massachusetts and the District of Columbia, she knew either no one or at least just one person who had voted for Richard Nixon, which tells us what kind of world Pauline Kael lived in. And thus that quote has been famous almost ever since because it points to the increasing secularization, the political isolation of those in the intellectual elites, including Pauline Kael. But a similar moment came yesterday in the aftermath of the release of the Pew Report when Byron Tal, who is the White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal, tweeted, quote, "From anecdotal experience, the number of people my age that I know who are Christians is close to zero," end quote. Now, just step back for a moment and realize what was there communicated. Here you have a major young figure in the intellectual elite of America. After all, he is the White House reporter, or at least a White House reporter, for the Wall Street Journal, one of the nation's most influential newspapers. And he writes, in all honesty and candor, that so far as his own experience is concerned, let me repeat the words, quote, "the number of people my age that I know who are Christians is close to zero," end quote. As I said, this is something of a new Pauline Kael moment, because that statement made by Pauline Kael in the aftermath of the Nixon re-election is rather echoed in the statement made by a White House reporter for the Wall Street Journal. But I don't raise the young man's statement in order to criticize him for making it. Rather, I simply want to point out that in all honesty, apparently he doesn't know any Christians, or at least he doesn't know anyone who identifies as a Christian, to any extent at least, that Byron Tao would know that that individual is a Christian. That tells us again what Pauline Kael's statement told us about the New York Times. Those who have these kinds of jobs tend to be rather isolated from the rest of the country. That's made clear even in the Pew report. But this also tells us something else. Here you have a young man in one of the most privileged media positions in America who is honestly just reflecting upon this report, saying, "I don't know anyone my age who is a Christian." In his words, "the number of people my age that I know who are Christians is close to zero," end quote. Without any doubt, that makes a certain statement of reflection upon Byron Tao. Without a doubt, it also makes a certain statement about Christians. Next, two articles that appeared in yesterday's edition of the New York Times tell us a great deal about the revolution taking place around us, about the worldview significance of the headlines that just pop up in the newspapers. In the first place, in yesterday's edition of the New York Times, page A12, you find the headline, "White House Warns Insurers About Surcharges and Gaps for Contraception." This has been widely reported in the media. The New York Times tells us, along with others, that the White House has been issuing directives to insurance companies. This has to do with authority granted under the Obamacare legislation, telling these insurance companies that they have to cover all forms of contraception without any kind of copayment required from anyone that has the coverage. As Robert Pear reports for the New York Times, the Obama administration on Monday put health insurance companies on notice that they must cover all forms of female contraception, including the patch and intrauterine devices, without imposing copayments or other charges. This comes after groups such as the National Women's Law Center and the Kaiser Family Foundation had issued reports indicating that there had been gaps in the coverage from several of the insurance companies. One of the most important sections of this article by Robert Pear includes these words, and I quote, "The new guidance also makes clear that insurers should cover preventative services for transgender people when a doctor finds that the services are medically appropriate," end quote. That gets into the whole transgender revolution, and it tells us here that you can expect this moral revolution on the issue of gender and sexuality to be translated, this article also makes clear, into an insurance revolution. Another sign that the Christian worldview affirms, and that is, if you make a moral change, it inevitably realigns the entire society. So people who are thinking about the transgender issue probably aren't first thinking about how this will impact insurance coverage. But now you have the Obama administration saying not only must insurers cover all forms of female contraception without any copayment, but also these insurers should cover transgender or sex reassignment surgery when advised that such surgery is medically appropriate by a physician. Now we enter into a whole new terrain in terms of insurance coverage. We enter into a whole new conversation about what medically appropriate means. We enter into a whole new conversation about the economic effects, not only on those who are seeking this kind of surgery, but for the rest of the insurance pool paying for it. We now look at the fact that the Christian worldview reminds us that we live in a social whole. We live in a situation in which worldview always works its way out, and we operate from a biblical understanding that as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. The biblical worldview starts out with the very clear understanding that if you change the most basic framework of thinking, you're eventually going to change everything. You're going to change law. You're going to change social custom. Yesterday, we looked on the briefing and the fact that people are trying to come up with mix as a way of replacing Mr. and Mrs. and Ms. and Miss simply because in the transgender revolution, in a denial of what's being called the binary separation of human beings into male and female, we've got an absolute confusion about how even to address one another. Every portion of the society will be changed. What happens in the schoolroom is going to be changed. What gets published in the textbooks is going to change. How children's books are published, what kind of pictures appear in them, that's going to change. And the rules of insurance coverage, that's going to change too. The entire economy will eventually be changed as well. The biblical worldview affirms what Christians must understand. If you change the way a society thinks morally, eventually you will change everything about that society. The second article also appeared in yesterday's edition of the New York Times, this time on page A18, the headline, quote, "Cuomo taking aim at campus sexual assaults calls for a stricter law," end quote. In this case, the Cuomo is New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. And as Elizabeth Harris reports for the Times, the governor, appearing at a Manhattan college with Representative Nancy Pelosi, on Monday called for the passage of what he called the toughest law in the nation on campus sexual assault. According to Harris, this was a message aimed at New York lawmakers who have expressed some reservations about what he has proposed. Harris goes on to tell us that the governor's proposed policies, which are already in place at New York's public colleges, would require the state's private colleges to adopt so-called affirmative consent policies as the standard of student behavior. As Harris says, quote, "putting the burden on an accused student to show that the other person had agreed to the sexual activity rather than making accusers prove that they had said no, silence, or lack of resistance would not be considered consent," end quote. Now, the point we've made over and over again on The Briefing is that when you deny, when you try to eradicate a Christian morality based on Scripture when it comes to sex, you're going to replace it with some morality. And this is the sole insufficient, the very thin morality that is left, as all a secular society can eventually muster. And that is a morality of sexual consent. But you'll notice how this consent has to be renegotiated and redefined all the time. There is something absolutely ludicrous and heartbreakingly tragic about a law that says sexual morality just comes down to consent. And that consent now has to be affirmative consent, where both parties have to somehow affirmatively consent to a specific act, or no consent is given. There is no definition, you may note, about what that might represent. There is no legal definition yet of what affirmative consent might require. And whether or not the governor gets the law he calls the strictest in the nation, what is abundantly clear is this: it won't settle the issue. It will not resolve the problem. It can't. Oh, and by the way, there are some other incredible moral insights in this article. Let me just read to you this paragraph. Quote, "Mr. Cuomo, a Democrat, has also proposed that students reporting sexual assaults must not be punished if they were violating a campus policy on drinking or drugs, with the goal," says the article, "of removing the fear that by coming forward, those reporting might be punished," administration officials say, end quote. So now students coming forward, and the only morality here is consent, now they're going to be forgiven any alcohol or drug offenses that might have been combined with the incident simply because that might prevent someone from coming forward. Once again, we just see the confused morality when you have the absence of a coherent biblical ethic. Just a couple of other quick insights. At least some legislators are complaining about the language of the bill because it defines the two people, the first person as victim and the second as accused. But as some legislators have pointed out, just using common sense, if one is identified as a victim, it's then impossible to say that there's merely an accusation. If one's a victim, then evidently something happened. This is a problem that has already shown up in the media, and now you have at least some legislators, undoubtedly some of them attorneys, saying these words simply don't work when put together. On the other hand, the last insight from this article comes in these words, quote, "In a statement after the speech, the governor said, quote, as a father of two college-age girls with a third on the way next year, this isn't just an important issue for the state, it's a personal issue for me, as it is for many parents who every fall say goodbye to their children with an expectation that their schools are doing everything they can to keep them safe," end quote. Now, I close by speaking not only as an observer of the governor's statements, but also as a father. Does any father actually think, in any honest way, that the adoption of these policies will make daughters safe? Safe for what? Presumably so-called safe sex? What we're looking at here is the meltdown of morality once a Christian biblical ethic is abandoned and denied. Once that biblical ethic is displaced, something's going to take its place. And this is very sad evidence of evidently the best a secular society can do in trying to come up with some replacement. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. We're taking questions for Ask Anything Weekend Edition. Just call with your question in your voice to 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.